You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 20th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Christina Beltran, author of Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. Also on the program today, wildfires rage in the West as nature is trying to tell us something. Meanwhile, in Washington, the bipartisan infrastructure deal on the verge of collapse. Same may be true of the Olympics in Japan as COVID spreads among the athletes. Polling shows American unvaccinated largely unmovable. New report, DOJ declined to prosecute Wilbur Ross despite five separate referrals. Question now is, where is Merrick Garland? Federal judge says Indiana University can require students to get COVID vaccinations to return to campus. And Ben and Jerry's to stop selling ice cream in occupied territories. Meanwhile, in Peru, Pedro Castillo declared president. And lastly, Jeff Bezos figures out how to spend a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of his money by taking a ride in a rocket ship. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma Vigeland joins me as well, as always. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
So, folks, today we should say it's a little bit sad for us here today. We're trying to, you know, make it sort of a somewhat joyful celebration. A year ago on this day, the host of the Michael Brooks Show, former contributor on this show, co-host of this program, producer of this program, Michael Brooks passed away a year ago on this day. And in the second half of the program, we're going to dedicate to just reminiscing about Michael and remembering him. He was a many different things, I think, to many different people, obviously. He provided a lot of fun on this program and great insight. We'll go through all of this and his trajectory in the second half of the program. But he worked on the show from 2012, I guess, to 2020, 8 years, the longest single work relationship of my lifetime, certainly had the longest tenure on this program, aside from myself. I don't think there's anybody who works on this show who doesn't think about him at least every day that we do the show. We still have many elements that have been produced to that are interstitials that involve Michael. It would be hard to imagine them not. And of course, I think that's the same of the audience. In many respects, a lot of people have watched Michael sort of almost grow up in some ways. He first came to the show in 2012 with the idea that he was just going to do it for a year. I think he had been had done an internship or at Talking Points Memo writing. And his original plan was going to do this for a year, and then he was going to go to, I think it was the LSE in London. And at one point I realized, like, he doesn't seem to be going. And he, his show, when he launched it, it was the second or third sort of project that he had launched, grew exponentially. It was very, the growth was huge. And he was a very unique voice in this space. And I think from my perspective, what I miss the most is the sort of the comedy and the fun that he created on this show. And so we're going to play one clip of him now. We may play other clips, and we're going to have some friends call in, and we're going to open up our phone lines to the audience to call in and give maybe talk about some of their favorite moments or aspects of Michael's work. But this one I chose because I was just saying to these guys, we have done about 2,700 episodes of this iteration of the Majority Report. I had done, you know, 4 or 5 years worth of shows on Air America Radio. But over the course of the 10 and a half years we've been doing this show, we're now at about 2,700 episodes. There may be a little bit more. And I can remember about 5 of those. And but the moments that I remember from this show were almost all 5 of them were moments of laughing either with Michael or generating the laughs with Michael. Laughing at him. There was a couple of those times there, actually. But this moment happened back in 2013. So Michael had been with the show at this point by probably less than a year. And maybe it was about a year. And the other producer was Matt Binder. We were in a room that was about maybe about 200 square feet, 3 of us. It was not a pleasant office. It was in the fashion district of New York City, and it was very not fashionable. We had windows that overlooked a brick wall that we had to keep shut because of the soot. And we were right on top of each other, basically. And you'll see the tech on this clip is not. And I don't even think we were live. Except for audio at that point. But we did take video. We didn't have the ability to cut because we only had one camera. And before this moment, Michael and I must have talked about it. I didn't know that he really did impressions. I don't know that he ever anticipated using them on the show. But there was a clip of Rick Santorum, who I think this was in I think this was in response to Mandela's death, but I'm not 100% sure. I believe it was. And Rick Santorum was on CNN comparing the Republican fight against the ACA to the long trajectory and fight of Nelson Mandela's life, which I hope it was understandable. We found completely absurd. And so we started talking about this, and I think Michael must have said beforehand, like, I'll do a Mandela impersonation. And we probably said, like, yeah, you'll talk about how you're actually, like, conservative too. And this moment I always remember because it really did begin to shape the show in the way that I wanted. I had always hoped that the show would be, that we'd be able to integrate comedy, satire, into, you know, talking about the news, and never really contemplated it being about impressions or specifically one about Nelson Mandela being a right winger. But this is how that developed. There you have it, folks. Obamacare is like apartheid. Obamacare is like the repression, literal repression, of the majority of Americans. Americans under Obamacare, a vast majority of them, can't eat in the same restaurants, must live in slums, can't have access to the natural resources of their country, cannot have an equal vote, cannot have... I mean, that's what Obamacare is for Rick Santorum, because he's so, so stupid. Yeah, you want to do Mandela?
It was like in Santorum.
We hadn't quite worked out the smooth transition at this point, but go ahead.
And Mandela comes out and he's like, of all of the injustices in the world that could remind me of the struggle against apartheid, the delivery of health care through a private market mechanism, none could face the same level of injustice and tyranny that Americans face by having an inconvenient website so that they are covered in a catastrophic situation. You should fight this.
Now, I want to know, when's Rick Santorum going to go into prison for 27 years to fight this? Unbelievable.
The names Santorum, Gingrich, and other heroes of the struggle against the slightly expanded Medicaid. You will go down in history along with Otto Vertombo, Walter Sisulu, and other great comrades who have fought an evil injustice.
How demented are these people?
So
it's
demented.
It's so much better if they could just say Mandela was a communist. Screw him.
Oh,
I mean, like, my God.
Right.
So there it is. I mean, longtime listeners of this program will be surprised that Michael ended that so quickly. and you can hear Matt Binder, old Matt, as we call him around here, in the background cackling. And we, you know, there was the first time that we had done something like that, to my memory. And it, you know, obviously we got a little smoother with that stuff as we went along, and then the dynamic was less, you know, Michael, do more. It was like, okay, Michael, that's enough. It really, it changed, the trajectory of the show and made it, personally just, I mean, I think more obviously made it much more enjoyable for the audience. But
yeah, like that sort of way of communicating became our main mode on the show and off, like
yes,
in the office.
Yes, it sort of took over. And we'll talk more about this kind of stuff in the second half of the program. We're going to have, you know, some of Michael's friends call in, and Michael's sister will call into the program. And everybody will, you know, reminisce and just remind themselves of Michael in their own way. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll be talking to the Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University, author of Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. We'll be right back with Christina Beltran after this. Hey, today's episode is brought to you by the new podcast from Chapo Trap House's Matt Chrisman and Chris Wade, Hell of Presidents. From Washington to Biden, Hell of Presidents is telling the history of the United States through the office of the presidency, all the in the irreverent Chapo Trap House style. Who are all these men, and why should you even really care? Listen to Hell of Presidents to find out. Hell of Presidents is available exclusively on Stitcher Premium,
To sign up and to get a free month of listening, go to stitcherpremium.com/hell on your mobile or desktop browser. Click start free trial, select a monthly plan, and enter the code hell at stitcherpremium.com/hell. Promo code hell. All right. Want to welcome to the program, Associate Professor, Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University, author of Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy, Christina Beltran. Christina, thanks so much for joining us. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, thanks for having me, Sam.
So, okay, let's start with, I guess, you know, this concept of a project of whiteness, and how it is. What does that mean? Let's start with that.
Right. Well, I started this book because I was trying to make sense of why immigration, particularly from Latin America and Mexico, was such a site of such visceral hostility on the right. Right. And why the fact that it was such an emotionally galvanizing issue, and why did migrants in particular seem to, you know, create such passionate opposition for conservatives. And in thinking about that, I also wanted to think about, like, what are the pleasures of violence as well? Like the fact that people seem to be not only doing violence, but also kind of enjoying talking about and taking a certain kind of pleasure in talking about the fact that they were, you know, putting up barbed wire fencing, children in cages. And so in trying to figure out, like, what is the sort of center of this sort of hostility, I realized I had to think about whiteness as a political project. And so in the book, one thing I'm trying to talk about is I'm talking about whiteness not simply as a race. I'm not talking about just white people. I'm talking about people who are invested in a politics of whiteness as a political color, which means a politics that is embedded in a politics of domination, but not just a politics of domination, but a politics of domination in which one feels more free when creating inequality for others, right? That one's own sense of sovereignty or freedom or equality is centered on the idea that some people don't have access to that. And so for me, when you think about the United States, you know, with the brief period of Reconstruction as this effort to kind of undo what scholars have sometimes referred to as white democracy, when we look sort of past that moment that was sort of a failed moment in this country, and then we don't really until 1964 and 65, do we have a country where we really have legal equality for people across racial difference, right? So it's a really embedded part of our history that, you know, segregation, Chinese exclusion, Jim Crow, you know, these things are really embedded in our politics. And so I was trying to make sense of how it isn't just like a bad prejudice thing, but really think about it as how has it affected our sense of democracy, our sense of freedom? And so that's kind of what prompted the book.
Well, talk about this concept of cruelty tied to civic identity, because I think that that was such a, you know, a well articulated phrase that fits into this concept of white democracy historically and in present day.
Yeah. Thanks. No, it's one of those interesting issues. I was reading, you know, a lot of different scholars, and one scholar who really struck me was Pierre Vandenberg had written a book where he used the term Herrenvolk democracy. And what struck me about that term is, you know, Herrenvolk refers to the idea of the master race, and we know that from Nazi Germany and that sort of that logic. But what he says is he describes the term as democratic for the master race, but tyrannical for subordinate groups. And that really struck me is that, because one thing I think is that when you have these sort of forms of racial violence, they don't just feel like you're just being lawless. They actually feel like the rule of law, right? They feel like people feel like what they're doing is kind of practicing the rule of law for themselves. So it struck me as interesting that tyranny and liberalism could be conjoined in this particular way. But in thinking about that, what really struck me was, and I think we don't talk about this enough in our country, in our history, is that when we think about things like Jim Crow, we tend to think of that as like, I always think we think of those segregated, water fountains. Right? One says colored, one says white, right? But the reality of Jim Crow and the reality of segregation was it was a deeply participatory act. Segregating people took a lot of effort and it took a lot of work. And so a lot of people were participants in creating segregated spaces, right? I mean, it was all the way from, you know, bus drivers, waitresses, real estate. If you were a real estate, you know, person who worked in real estate, if you were a usher at a movie theater. So one thing I really wanted to think about was how white supremacy and segregation created a lot of participation for a lot of people, and that that actually made them feel like they had a certain kind of power to tell people where they could move, where they could sit, what spaces in public they could occupy, which swimming pools, which parks. And so when you think about it as a participatory, in some sense, democratic project for certain white citizens, then you realize that it also offered people a sense of their own power. It made them feel like they had something that somebody didn't have. And so when you start thinking about that kind of pleasure, you start realizing that that's a pleasure that, you know, not only does it go to extra legal violence like lynchings or, you know, the Tulsa riots, those sorts of moments of kind of lawless, you know, engagement, but that it, on the very small ways, or not even, they're not small, but in these very daily ways, these very quotidian ways, there was a pleasure in for some white citizens in creating segregated space, that it made them feel powerful. It made them feel like they had something. And so I wanted to think about the kind of regime of domination that could go from serving on an all-white jury all the way to lynching, to participating in a lynching, to reading about the lynching in the newspaper, that it really was something that was, unfortunately, we can characterize it as civic. It was a civic element of American life.
What? I mean, that's fascinating because it's basically just sort of like, we're all invested in this civic project of just making sure that we suppress a specific population or a couple of specific populations. I mean, you start to really begin to understand this sort of like bizarre fetishization of the wall on some level, that Donald Trump was. You know, it's a big, beautiful wall. It's almost like it's a monument to we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Except for the people that we have specifically said are not in this with us, so that we have this ability to sort of join in the in-group. What is there? And I guess, you know, and we can talk about like that's you begin to understand why it's so important to hang on to the notion of illegals as a term, right? Because what we're doing is an illegal civic structure. And the reason why we can do this is because they're illegals. And therefore, they're playing a role in this, too. It's just that they're playing the illegals role. But we're like, if this isn't innate to Americans, right? Like, I mean, you're talking about a human dynamic, not necessarily with all human beings, but with certain types of folks who want to feel like they're in a project and part of their project is the subjugation of other people. Like, where else? I mean, I guess maybe as I'm saying it, I'm thinking of a couple of examples, but where else do we see something like this play out?
Right, right. No, and I think that's really two things you said I think are so important, because one of them is but yeah, certainly, you know, when I cited Vandenberg, like, you know, he talks about Brazil, Mexico, South Africa. So I think I wish we did have a better comparative analysis of racial difference, how racism functions, colonialism, how these legacies play out in different places. So that, you know, you think of like James Baldwin writing about going to Paris and feeling free for the first time. And then he realizes he's in a cab with an Algerian cab driver, and he realizes, oh, you know, there's a legacy of difference and colonial practice here that doesn't touch me in the same way, but is certainly here as well. And you realize these are global phenomenon that we have to understand. And I, you know, I think one of the ways we have to think about that is they have these connections and they have these similarities, but it really requires, I think, scholars and journalists to really dig down into the specific histories of particular places. So we might see these things happening in all kinds of places, but they do have very particular histories with particular communities. And you need to sort of understand that in order to maybe understand how to undo it. And so one of the things I was thinking a lot about was the fact that a lot of our discussion around race still kind of operates on a black-white binary, and we have to sort of think about these other populations and how do they fit into chattel slavery, white supremacy, because I think you have to understand those things, you know, settler colonialism, indigenous dispossession. You have to understand that history to understand any other population and how they're being treated, because those set the terms of American life in so many ways. But I do think that one of the elements that I wanted to spend time on was looking at like the Mexican-American War and looking at the frontier. And when you think about the frontier as like a space in which Americans really conceived of themselves as engaging in a project where there was freedom through movement, right? And this idea that you could move across the land and claim space and make it your own, And you made it your own through the hard work of building those spaces and settling them and building, you know, communities and schools and, you know, civic organizations. But you also made it through displacing people, sometimes through enhancing and expanding slavery. But this idea that freedom and movement were so deeply tied, right? And then, but our history of racism is often telling certain populations, like Jim Crow, telling them where they couldn't move, where they can't be. And I think what's interesting about the undocumented is after 1965, you know, you couldn't police, I mean, I think the policing practices in this country are one way we police the movements of Black people and brown people. But the policing of the movement of people wasn't as possible when it came to, after Jim Crow, after the demise of those legally in 1965 and 64. So I think what's interesting about the undocumented is they remain one of the few populations you can still invoke the language of law. You can still say they are illegal. You can invoke the rule of law to dominate them and to impose violence on them. And you can claim that you're doing it because you have to, because it's the law. And you can kind of, you know, invoke legality to do violence. And I think that's for some citizens, that's a very seductive practice that you can dress up and join a militia and literally round up people and be allowed to do that. Like, there's no other population. You can just go to some portion of the country and round them up and then call in, you know, ICE or the police, and they will come and get them. Like, that whole practice has a very long history in our country, with the Texas Rangers. And there's a long history there that I try to write about in the book, but there is an interesting history. It made people feel like they were doing their civic duty, and there aren't a lot of populations you can treat that way. But because they're non-citizens, right, in a way that African Americans were once non-citizens in a particular way, now this population are non-citizens, and that creates a certain kind of opportunity structure for how to treat them.
And I imagine too, this notion of mobility being sort of a birthright of citizenship, and then you have the mobility constraints lifted, you know, at the end of Jim Crow. But you're doubling down on the idea that, like, we can't have them just roam across the border here, these illegals. That's, I mean, that, you know, that's the ultimate flaunting of the right of citizenship to constrain their mobility.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things that's so interesting is we talk about, you know, Jonathan Metzer's written about death by whiteness, and different scholars have written about the deaths of despair, and this sense for a certain segment of white citizens that the world is getting smaller, and they have a really dystopian, negative sense of they have no sense of futurity, right? They sense that the future is only going to get worse. I think there's a scarcity logic of white supremacy, or sort of the politics of whiteness, where people feel like if they're not on top, somebody else is dominating them. Like, there's no logic of sharing. Right. Like, I'm a political theorist by training, and I always think of Aristotle's definition of a citizen is someone who rules and is ruled in turn. Right. It's about never being only ruled or only ruling. It's about always going back and forth with the practice of being ruled and ruled in turn. And it's about sharing power. Right. And of course, for Aristotle, he didn't include all kinds of populations. So granted, but the idea that we share power, that we trade it back and forth, that the logic of America's earlier history, I think, makes certain white citizens feel like there is no sharing. It's either we're on top or you're on top. Either we dominate or we're dominated, right? So when you have that logic that is always sort of a scarcity logic, that only certain people are allowed to have something and we can't, I think this feeling that their lives are getting more and more constrained and narrow. And then on the other hand, they look at migrants and they see migrants doing, you know, claiming their freedom through movement, and not necessarily, you know, letting the law stop them. Like, they ultimately say, I need to save my children, so I'm gonna cross this border. But the same way, you know, not the same way, but with echoes of earlier forms of movement that maybe different populations felt they had access to. And these populations that are moving aren't trying to move to displace or dominate. But I think when you have a logic of displacement and domination that already circulates, when they see that kind of movement, that's the narrative that they attach to, right? And so it's interesting to see that the group that feels a sense of their own futurity, they're trying to fight for a future, that isn't inspiring, that is terrifying. And that's one of the problems we have.
And I guess part of that too is just this casting of Latino people specifically now in current modern day as anti-citizen, which you write about, or anti-citizenry. How does that concept evolve or get to this point? Because you know, of course there are differences internationally among different, you know, nations and ways the world is perceived, but this one seems particularly American.
Yeah. I think this idea that you know, there was a scholar named Judith Schlar who wrote about African Americans and characterized them as being like anti-citizens, in the sense that the very act of their claiming citizenship would somehow reduce or threaten the citizenship of white citizens, right? So it is that zero-sum logic that if this population has access to citizenship, this could actually render my citizenship less meaningful. And, you know, sometimes we even hear that now where, you know, someone like Tucker Carlson will say, you know, if they vote, my vote means nothing. Like they'll literally create that kind of anti-citizen, even if they're citizens, their citizenship is literally undoing my own citizenship, you know? And so I think that it does have this interesting long history that it doesn't assume, I think liberals often assume, oh, you know, we can create this more expansive, inclusive logic. And I think we can. But I think what's interesting is we have to contend with certain segments of the American public that feel like it can't be expansive, that if it grows, they lose something, that somehow their membership gets watered down or threatened, as opposed to, you know, we actually can be in a politics where, you know, all of us have, you know, that if I have rights, if gay people, if trans people have rights, that doesn't mean that rights are less, right? If some people can get married and they're gay, you know, and straight people can get married, it doesn't make your marriage less of a marriage, right? But there's a scarcity logic.
Let's talk about that, because I think that there is some reality to that scarcity of logic. I mean, I don't subscribe to it. And I think to some extent, like, okay, sorry, you know, I mean, it's like you're an only child, and then all of a sudden there's a second kid there. It's like, yeah, guess what? You're not the only child anymore. But like in the context of this zero sum, I mean, Tucker Carlson is right insofar as every time somebody turns 18 or every time an immigrant becomes a citizen, his vote, you know, at least as a mathematical, is, you know, infinitesimally, but actually is diminished, just like my vote and your vote is. And, you know, I mean, I've used this example ad nauseum on this program in terms of, you know, a white person seeing a white male is seeing themselves not centered in everything in the way that it, you know, we were 30 or 40 years ago and before. Mm-hmm. And the idea of like my traditions and favorite foods and my language just not as dominant and as central as it was before. So there is some loss there. I mean, my perspective on this is like, okay, well,
sorry,
but there is some loss there, right? I mean, this is not imaginary. It is real, and it is having this grasping onto that sort of centralization is not a terribly democratic impulse, it seems to me, but it is a real impulse, and yeah, it is like a material difference on some level.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I think one thing that we have struggled to even talk about is that sense of loss, right? That sense of when one is always the center of everything, when there's no other, when there's no logic of sharing. Right. And I think it's funny, your example at the beginning of like an only child, you know, getting a sibling, right? Like when you don't necessarily have a logic of sharing, right? And then you find out that you have to share, but then perhaps sharing, you also gain a playmate. Like you gain other things. There are new, your parents aren't like, I have 20% of love and now you get 10%. Like, right. They, you know, that the connections and commitments grow and create new, you know, emotional formations, right? But you also do experience a loss. Like those, I think we don't know how to sort of reckon with the simultaneity of the fact that you can lose something and gain something, that something new can happen. I think like Heather McGee's work in The Sum of Us is trying to kind of get at that, right? That you can lose something. You can lose the pleasures of domination. You have to let go of certain, in some ways I would characterize them as like tyrannical pleasures, right? You have to let go of, you do lose access to the right to dominate, right? I mean, when Me Too was happening, and a lot of men were like, you can't even make jokes in the office anymore, and, you know, all these sensitive women, and you can't do this. And they're right, right? The way they operated in those spaces was changed. And there's a sense of, I don't get to be the person I was, right? But then there's also the possibility of being something else, having people, new ideas, having a new community, having other ways of being. But I do think that for certain people, right, it does, the world does feel it's changing very rapidly, and they don't, I think, you know, but I think it also creates this kind of, if you live within a logic of only losing, I guess what I'm saying is, if you live in a binary logic where there's either a loss or a gain, and there's nothing, and instead of the kind of fluid fact that there'll be a different way of being in the world together, which is hard to talk about and not easy to discuss the same way it is to just say you're losing, you're winning, right? But if you're losing that, I think there is this feeling of like, you know, I always laugh when, like, you know, there'll be a show and like the James Bond, you know, franchise will say, maybe we'll have a woman Bond. And they're like, men are dead and there's no place for men. It's like, there's right. just one. There can be like nine guys and one woman. And there's suddenly this feeling that they have nothing. It's all been taken from them. So I do think it reflects this idea that there hasn't been a logic of sharing. It's like, no, you know, it doesn't mean when people say the future is female, it doesn't mean it's only female. It means that sometimes Black women are going to be there. Sometimes white women, a whole bunch of us are going to be moving back and forth. You're going to have a seat at the table. You won't have all the seats. You'll have some chairs, not all the chairs. But I do agree with you. I think when you have had all the chairs, some chairs is fewer chairs, right? And you don't necessarily think, well, I'll get to talk to new people. There's going to be new ways of me feeling free, or me not having to carry the pressure of representation in these ways. Like, there's other things you get to maybe let go of that could make you feel, breathe differently and better. But I don't think we've exactly articulated what that new world looks like. So well, it just feels like loss.
Yes. And that's my follow-up question is, like, what do you, I mean, it is one thing, and I'm certainly guilty of it, of just saying, like, you know, suck it up. Sorry, you had a lot of privilege. You had a lot of control of things. You used to watch TV, and you were the focus of everything. It was, I mean, when I watched TV as a kid, it was like, is either about me or me as an older guy or my mom or my wife. That was, you know, my future wife. I mean, that's basically what every TV show was. But what is... What as a society, I mean, it's one thing, you know, if you're my therapist and you're telling me, like, you know, Sam, you just got to accept the fact that you're no longer centered in the same way. And there are other things that you can explore. Maybe you have less of a response. But as a political question, like, you know, how does a society that is emancipating people and both from an economic and social standpoint, I guess you could argue from an economic standpoint, there's, like, you know, continuous growth, although that may be problematic for other reasons, as we see half the country on fire and, half of Germany floating away or something to that effect. But how do you make that case, as a government or as a society that, look, you're losing the status that you've had, the social status, but you're gaining this. Like, how do you articulate that and show that vision of that new world?
Yeah, I think in some ways that is maybe the biggest important question for progressives and, you know, in this moment, actually, is, I think, two things, right? I think one thing is, it is really useful to talk about the loss. And it may be certain, you know, if you're a certain kind of, like, activist, you may not want to be the one talking about that loss, right? If you're like, you might be like, suck it up. I don't want to host you into this new world, right? Like, you know, you're going to need to have that conversation with some other folks, right? So I understand that certain, maybe different activist communities don't necessarily want to do that kind of work with people sometimes. On the other hand, I think we have two really big tasks, and one is a task of persuasion. And I think, you know, that is a really critical thing we need to be doing. I think sometimes we talk about politics, activist logics are very expressive, and I think those are super powerful. Sometimes you need to say, this is bad, this is broken, it needs to change now, right? That's a completely legitimate political act, and we need those. But we also need people, you know, my dad was a labor organizer. My dad was an auto worker who became a labor leader, a labor organizer. And he always talked about the fact that you had to grow the ground of agreement. And they always talk about the fact that when I enter into a space where I'm trying to organize a union, I need to meet people where they are and try to get them to see why, where I want, where I think they ought, this would be good for them, right? Joining this union. So you had to sort of meet people where they are and bring them in. And maybe because I'm a professor, I'm a teacher. I think that's a really, I think when we're organizers, we also have to be teachers engaged in a practice of persuading, which means meeting people where they are and trying to help them imagine a better world, right? But I also think that as progressives and politically, we need to find a language. I've been calling it like the politics of abundance, or maybe like an aesthetics of justice, which are all super academic-y terms that will not catch on ever. But my point being is that we need to try to imagine a future that looks beautiful for everybody, a future that people can look at and say, I would like to live there. That world looks really appealing to me. Not like this is a world where I have less of everything, but this is a world where maybe I don't have as much of that, but I have more of this. And that looks like a world I want to inhabit. Like, I think painting a picture of a world, because if we don't, the right is really good at saying Biden wants to take your hamburgers, they want to take sodas. You know, everything is about less carbon, different, you know, everything is about less, right? Having less. And there's a real reason for that. But I do think we need a language that says, here's this new possible world that could look amazing in these ways. And so that people who maybe are persuadable, some people I don't think are persuadable, they're really locked into their politics. But I think there are a lot of people who aren't sure what the new future looks like. We've never inhabited it. And so they need to be invited into something.
How much of that is simply a function? And I agree with you, you know, the entire, you know, right wing mentality is constantly talking about loss, you know, ranging from, you know, you will not replace us down to, you know, you're diminishing my vote and, you know, you're taking my freedoms by being an illegal here. Mm-hmm. How much of this needs to be addressed with material benefits? I mean, you know, if I, as a white male, am like, you know, looking into a universe of like, okay, I no longer have the ability to go in and comment on my coworker's legs, and I am, you know, watching television and this black person is centered, or I, you know, I'm talking on the phone and I've got to press 2 to speak English, you know, that type of thing. How much of the answer is really just material benefits? Because if all of a sudden now, like, I have parental leave, or I have paid sick leave, or I have, frankly, health insurance that is paid for, and I don't have, like, the certain stresses that are associated with, you know, my cultural status or my perceived cultural status are removed just on a material level. I mean, how much can it be that? I mean, because, like, we're not going to have like a group therapy session for everybody. And it's not going to be, you know, and I don't know how open somebody would be to like the idea of like, hey, you don't have to worry about being the sole breadwinner anymore. You know, we're moving into a new world where, you know, you can, you know, however that gets articulated, it seems to me much easier if all of a sudden I just have like, I don't have to earn as much money. This is decommodified type of thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the rise of the highest numbers of immigration have also happened during the same period in this country, of some of the highest numbers, as the gutting of the welfare state starting with Reagan, right? So it's been, you know, 50 plus years, 40 plus, 45, whatever, years of sort of neoliberal politics of undercutting the welfare state, right? And also massive growing inequality. So I think those things are all deeply related, right? The fact that people feel more precarious, there's more inequality, you know, all those things have created a really toxic civic stew for us to have to kind of deal with. So I do think that having people have a sense that they have a future, that they have some sort of possible world they can imagine themselves inhabiting, really does matter. And I think that good policies can make a huge difference in that way, when people just feel like things aren't as hard. On the other hand, I do think there's a really entrenched logic for a lot of people. I mean, I think the fact that we're dealing with a global pandemic and we're dealing with people who won't get vaccinated. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me right now is that we kind of understand why conservative politics is willing to make non-white populations experience scarcity, right? Like why they think that's okay for them. What's interesting is, and so in that logic, you'd think, well, when the vaccines came out, white, you know, conservatives would have wanted to hoard the vaccines just for themselves and not let, you know, black and brown people have them. And instead, they themselves want to live under conditions of more precarity and violence for themselves. Like, that really strikes me, is that you have communities that they don't only want, they're not fighting for climate change for their own grandchildren. So there's something really deep about the fact that there's a kind of, I don't know if it's a kind of nihilism or a kind of despair that doesn't even imagine saving their own lives sometimes, or they might think they are because they think that the virus, the vaccines are poison or whatever, or magnetize them. But this idea that they will, you know, people who were sick still didn't believe in Obamacare. So I don't think it's just a matter of creating better resources. I think resources are really important, but I think that it's also, it really is about a slow creating of a different kind of change. And I think we have to think about creative ways of doing that at the local level, because we can't just do this at a national level. Biden's not going to give some speech that's going to make us think we could share, right? This is going to happen in communities. It's going to happen in schools. It's going to happen in, you know, civic spaces. I wish we had national service for every, you know, citizen at 18, or some sort of program also for non-citizens, but something at 18 where we did something civic together. Like, I think we need to actually be pretty creative about ways of creating, of breaking out of some of these cycles. And it's not going to come because some leader just gives a great speech, or that we cut a lot of checks. It will help to have a more vigorous, vibrant welfare state, more resources for people. But I don't think that will necessarily be enough. I think it's a really critical step, but not the only one.
Well, it's like, oh, you know what, I'm going to go down with this ship, because the resentment is just so strong, right? And it's so permeated. And I know Sam kind of touched on this earlier, but you have to make that ship worth saving so that people don't say, you know, screw it, all of us are going to go down together, which sounds insane to me. But yeah, say something.
Well, I was going to say, like, I don't think that they perceive the ship going down with the vaccine, but I do think it's there's a togetherness. I mean, I think the idea is that it's another form of developing a sense of community, in the same way that they see it as a civic duty to be cruel to immigrants as a way of, like, us and them. You know, the vaccine could have gone easily, it seems to me, the other way. I mean, I think, you know, had Donald Trump woken up one day and be like, actually, no, this is, we need to have the vaccine and we need to make sure the right people get it first, the most important people. And it would have been a completely different dynamic. But since we're on the topic of Trump, and I know that you have some thoughts on this, the we have seen Trump did better with Latino voters and Black voters than we've seen from Republicans in a while. And which I think a lot of people are sort of shocked, because he has not hid his hostility for Latino people or Black people, for that matter. How does that fit into the context of what you're talking about?
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think one thing that is really important in my book, one thing I really talk about is that different populations, that anti-Blackness in this country has a very specific history. And it's unfortunately a history that other communities have participated in. And it's important to always remember that Latinos are not a race. Latino is, you can be white, you can be Black. I always tell my students, like, have you watched baseball? Like, there are Black Latinos, like, you know, where Afro-Latinos are like a thing. Like, we are Black, we are white, we are mestizo. So it's not a race. So understanding that means understanding that Latinos, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, et cetera, that the politics of race are complicated, right? You can have populations that identify as Black, also populations that want to very much not be Black. And so anti-Black racism, which isn't, you know, we see this in Latin America with colorism, we see it, and we see it in the US. So the politics of race in these communities, you know, we talk like, oh, Black and brown populations, but the brown part of that story is actually much more racially complicated. And my first book was called The Trouble with Unity, and it really was trying to unpack the deep diversities within Latino, Latinx populations. And so that is something we have to think about. And so you have, on the one hand, a lot of Latinos who are engaged and understand themselves as people of color and in racial justice movements. We should always remember that even with 2020, the vast majority of African-Americans, the vast majority of Latinos voted for Joe Biden, voted as Democrats. However, and they didn't vote as high for the Republicans as they did under George W. Bush, where George W. Bush got closer to like 35 to 40%
right
of the vote, and Trump got less. So that's an important just historical fact. But he did do a lot better with particular populations, and not just Cubans. You know, Cubans have been historically more Republican. So people were like, oh, it's the Cubans. It's like, no, actually, there are Mexican Americans in South Texas voting for him as well. And so I think we have to, and that's one reason why I was pointing out that when I talk about whiteness as an ideology, I'm talking about the legacy of white supremacy in this country that has haunted us and has impacted all of us. We are all shaped by that legacy. No, I mean, why would something that powerful not touch all of us? So it shouldn't surprise us that certain non-white populations, or populations that are often deemed non-white, would also be seduced by the politics of domination, right? That they would get drawn in. And I'm not saying every person of color who voted Trump did it because they're invested in the politics of domination. They might have liked his taxes. They might have liked that he was on a TV show. Right. People vote for all kinds of reasons. But I do think a certain segment of those voters were attracted to the outrageousness and the racial politics that he articulated. And if you're a third generation Mexican American, for example, you don't really speak Spanish anymore, you know, your family's intermarried with lots of different communities, your understanding or sense of solidarity with non-citizen migrants might be very thin. You might not know anybody who's a non-citizen. So we're dealing with like 60 million people, 60 million Latinos in the US. They're not all doing one thing, right? Their politics are doing all kinds of things. And often we talk about them like in this monolithic way, like the Latino vote. There isn't a Latino vote. There are Latino voters, and they vote in a lot of different ways. And we have to get better at analyzing that in the same way we vote, like we talk about the women's vote. Well, there were a lot of women who like Trump. There's a lot of different kind of women voters. And so, yeah.
How much of it is, and this is just, you know, obviously this is just my own personal experience, but a friend of mine is Puerto Rican, and her family were adamant Trump supporters. And there was, she had a sense that this was a function of wanting to be as American as possible. And that when, and obviously Puerto Rico, you're American, but to be seen as American. Like, I'm just thinking of like those, you know, in the wake of 9/11, how, you know, so many guys driving a cab or something had to put an American flag in their car on some level. Obviously not the same thing, but the concept of if somebody's out there creating such a big dividing line, you're either on this side of it or on that side of it. And if there's any ambiguity, that sort of like going in one direction hard as a way of establishing your bona fides. Is that a thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing you're really pointing to also, which I think is another project for progressives, is how do you create a sense of membership? And, you know, progressives on the whole, we're very anxious about patriotism as a logic because it feels really nativist and it often feels really kind of USA, kind of, it feels aggressive in ways. It has a legacy that we're not super down with. So, but I think if we, but we also love where we love our country. We love where we live. We love the places we belong to. We love the people we have connections to. So I think we need some kind of language of membership that offers people a way of feeling like they belong to something they feel passionately about and care about, whether that's a progressive patriotism or we want to call it something else. But I do think that if the dominant language of patriotism has been steeped in a certain kind of nativism or a certain kind of politics of aggressive Americanism, then yeah, you could imagine people who want to be a part of that might be seduced by that or might find pleasures in it, right? And I mean, the fact of the matter is, if, you know, lots of population, I mean, Puerto Ricans are citizens, right? So anytime Puerto Rican communities identify with migrants, which many do, there's lots of progressive Puerto Rican civic organizations that are very pro-immigration, that's a solidarity stance. So it's not, they're not, you know, they're standing in solidarity with migrants. They're not like them. They are not their citizens. And frankly, anytime Latino voters vote on immigration reform, every Latino voter is a Latino US citizen.
Right.
So it's a solidarity language. It's not a language of just like if I'm gay and I vote for gay marriage, I'm voting for something that's like going to impact my life in this particular way. You might be a citizen with lots of non-citizen family. You might be in a mixed status family. So you might be voting what you see is for us. But that us is produced through solidarity. And the good news about that is I can feel solidarity for trans youth. I can feel solidarity for Black lives. I can feel solidarity across difference. So we can all do that. So solidarity politics opens up a lot of different ways of feeling connected and feeling a sense of belonging and membership to people who don't look like me. So I do think, but I think that the maybe the dark side of solidarity is you can be a non-white person and feel solidarity with Donald Trump. You can be a non-white person and feel solidarity with the Oath Keepers, right? So I think understanding how the kind of politics of domination, which in America is steeped in a racial politics of whiteness, we need to think about the way that that can seduce non-white populations as well. And in the same way, that I think one reason why we're so divided right now is because white America today, and I really try to spend some time in the book on this, is that white America today is more racially divided than it's ever been. There are more white people who are openly appalled by racism in a way than have ever been in the history of this country. There was a kind of consensus around certain kind of racial politics that even liberals in the Northeast kind of abided by. That is no longer the case. That's why families are fighting like hell on Facebook and at Thanksgiving, because a lot of white people are like wanting to stand with an anti-racist politics. So for me, that's an incredibly important good news moment, but it does make us feel more divided. But I would say we feel more divided in part because the politics of this country are no longer, being white and being attached to a politics of whiteness are no longer the same thing. They never always were, but they're less and less that. And that is freaking out the right. The right is more freaked out about Joe Biden, frankly, I think, than Obama in some ways, because that those white people standing on the side of racial justice, that's really scary in places like Georgia.
Christina Beltran, Associate Professor, Director and Director of Graduate Studies at the Department of Social Cultural Analysis, New York University, author of Cruelty as Citizen, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back to wrap it up.
Wait a minute. Pause. Hit the pause button. Something's wrong.
That was perfect. I love that. I
All right, folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are not, we will head into the fun half of the program. Joining us, among other people, Alicia Brooks will be here to talk about Michael and others. Just as an example, can't remember exactly at what point in the interview, but I do still hear Michael mocking me at one point, like after, I think when she said, we love our family and we love our thing. And I could just imagine Michael going, you know, as soon as she said goodbye, like, well, Sam, you don't. I mean, that is, something to that effect. That would have been a moment where Michael would have mocked me. I missed that.
Well, I did think of that when, or like something to that effect, when she said, you know, when you have your second kid, you don't divide your love up. It's a different kind of love.
Exactly.
Right? That would have been yes. A primary opportunity for Michael to.
Exactly. That is, I don't know what it says about me that is one of the big things that I miss, but so be it. And we will hear from you. As to what you miss about Michael on the show and others. In the meantime, just a reminder, you can check out Nomi's show at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, Tuesdays and Thursday evenings. Also, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe?
There's a Griscom stream on at about 3 on the Left Reckoning YouTube today, and also, we put out a Patreon episode, Andrew Hartman on the Culture Wars. That's patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get that episode that released on Monday.
Okay, folks. Number 646-257-3920. We will take your IMs. And let's try and, keep it about Michael today. But I guess if you're a libertarian and you call in, he would have appreciated that, too. All right. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy.